Hello and welcome to BCFM's Friday Drive Time. I'm Tony Gosling, and our guest to review the week's news in Bristol, Britain and around the world is Lib Dem councillor for Henlees and Bristol's cabinet member for children and young people, Claire Campion-Smith. Our old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers is here too. And after the 6 o'clock news, in a report carried over from last week, we ask, who is SAS Major, ex-SAS Major, John Wick, the man with a copy of the private House of Commons hard drive, who started the whole MP's expenses scandal? And we're joined by Chris Hawkins, ex-merchant banker, and also from the board of Barton Hills Community at Heart back in 2005. He'll be discussing the recession with Martin Summers. Will it double dip? We'll also be talking to Chris about his current work as part of the Child and Parent Alliance. And Lilia Patterson will be joining us. She'll be giving her impression of her extensive travels in the Middle East. That's in the second hour. On to this week's news in a minute, but first, here's our two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. This weekend, temperatures averaging 10 degrees Celsius, wet on Saturday, but sunny spells on Sunday. Averaging next week around about 9 degrees Celsius, fairly dry with plenty of sunny spells, wetter around Wednesday and Thursday though. Next weekend, that's the 27th and 28th of March, averaging 9 degrees Celsius, around about the same again, and sunny and dry on Saturday with some rain on Sunday. That's next weekend, not this weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from metcheck.com. Well, on to our look through the week's news, and joining me this week is Cabinet Member for Children and Young People, that's Lib Dem Councillor for Henlees, Claire Campion-Smith. Hi, welcome to Drive Time, Claire.
Thank you very much indeed for inviting me.
Now, first of all, by way of introduction, are you yourself from Bristol?
No, I'm not. I actually come from the northwest seaport of Liverpool, so I'm on the western fringe.
Okay, and do you have a day job as well as working as a councillor?
No, I used to be a teacher, but I've retired now.
And what sort of age children were you teaching?
I was teaching secondary children.
Okay, what subjects, or were you sort of, you know,
I was actually teaching them mathematics, and quite a few people go, ugh, when you actually say that, but it is a fascinating subject, and I really enjoyed it.
Okay.
Even if the children didn't always...
Did you manage to persuade to get the children interested in maths? Because I know a lot of young people, they're interested in some of the arts subjects like history, but they find maths a bit like, what's the point?
It can be so, and a lot depends upon their early experience of it. And interestingly enough, they seem to enjoy the investigations very often. So trying to make it too relevant didn't always work, but they liked the idea of exploring ideas.
But you're on the cabinet now in Bristol City Council, is that right?
Yes.
And can you just explain briefly how that system works?
Yes, it was a changeover at the beginning of the, sometime in 2000, I think. And the idea was, I suppose, to mirror to some extent the national government. So the ruling party creates a cabinet of about eight people. We all have our portfolios. We're subject to scrutiny by cross-party committees. So the decisions that we make can be called in if people aren't happy with them, and also they're scrutinised by other committees.
So how free are you to make your own decisions, or do you sometimes have your arm twisted behind your back a little bit by the accounts people saying, well, there's just not enough money for this?
That is a very, very strong constraint. I think it's going to get even stronger as well. I think the other thing which a lot of local politicians will say is that we are also constrained by what comes down from national government as well. And then, of course, we have to be answerable to the people.
Okay, which you will be soon. Are you one of the candidates that's up for re-election locally as well this year?
Yes, I am.
Okay, so final question just for you, and that is, what paper do you read? Do you have a national paper that you read most days, or do you have a favourite paper or several?
I don't read it as frequently as I ought to, but I do read The Guardian, and for one reason, I love some of the letters in The Guardian. I like the editorials, and it's my paper of choice.
You might have read some of Martin's letters, because he has a few letters in The Guardian from time to time. Anyway,
we're
also joined by Martin Summers, as our old Labour economics expert and pundit. Martin, question for you this week. Why do we keep hearing that quantitative easing, or the Treasury printing money, is going to finish like we did before Christmas, but Alistair Darling keeps doing more of it?
Well, that's because they're not quite sure what to do. They're thrashing around for policies. Quantitative easing is hardly a really brilliant thing to do. You do it as an emergency. And the question is, at what point have we stopped having an emergency and when can we give it up? And that's actually quite a tricky question.
Well, answer it for us then.
To my mind, the problem with quantitative easing is it's been used to actually lubricate the banks. If the government is basically going to print money, they should spend it directly into the economy, because that's the way to preserve demand.
What do you mean by upping public sector pay or something?
There's nothing wrong with people being paid higher wages. That's what you actually want to happen. Paying people lower wages actually takes demand out of the economy and can ultimately crash the economy.
Okay, so why is the government obsessed with giving this money to the banks rather than spending it?
Because they want to preserve the existing status quo banking system, and they can't think their way around the idea that maybe that's over. Maybe the whole private banking system will simply have to be nationalised for good. And nobody's actually saying that, because nobody wants to say it. It's an unthinkable think. But I'm afraid, in actual practice, that's where we are, and they're going to have to start thinking about it more seriously than they have been.
So why is it so unthinkable? Because, I mean, we've nationalised industries before in the past. I mean, so why not, if the banking sector's failing? Surely that's the
They have been forced to nationalise, not just in Britain but elsewhere, although Britain did take the lead on nationalisation after the Irish. But the point is, they've nationalised, but they're not actually exerting any control, and we saw this in the RBS fiasco. So the RBS, which is owned by the taxpayer, lends Kraft money, which it doesn't have, so it can take over Cadbury's in a hostile takeover, so that they can close down Keynsham and put 400 people out of work. Now, and the government just sits on its hands and says nothing to do with us. Well, hang on a minute, you own the bank that lent Kraft the money. Couldn't you have intervened at that point? No, because that would be intervening in the market, and we don't do that. And my answer to that is, why not?
Well, we're not looking at it specifically this week, Claire, but can I just have a quick comment from you on the Cadbury's thing in Keynsham, whether you think that the government should have intervened in some way to stop the sell-off or to make sure that the jobs were preserved in Keynsham?
Well, I feel very much the same way as Martin, actually. We do own the banks. We've poured billions into them. And it's about time that we took some control and we made them do what they are supposed to do, which is to lend money to businesses who can make a profit, who can drive the economy forward. And I don't really understand economics. Although I'm a mathematician, I actually fight shy of economics. But nevertheless, there's a sort of simplistic feeling to me that if you own the bank, as we do, then surely it should be delivering what we want for the country.
And if not?
Should
we be sacking the board of Royal Bank of Scotland and people like that?
I would be very happy to, but that is just an instinctive reaction at the moment, I'm afraid. But I think people need to address this particular issue.
Okay, well, let's hope they do.
There's a lot of pressure coming on now for a Tobin tax. Jeffrey Sachs was in The Guardian today saying, look, we shouldn't be cutting public expenditure, either in the United States or in Britain. If we've got a problem with finance, then we've got to tax financial transactions so that we get a fighting fund to pay for the things we want, because we don't want to be actually cutting spending. I mean, what's happening in Bristol is the cutting of all adult education classes, just at the moment when people are unemployed and they need the opportunity to retrain or just to keep their minds active, then suddenly everything's cut back. And this actually, as Keynes pointed out in the 30s, you can't downsize your way out of a recession. We should be investing in people, investing in infrastructure, and we say we can't afford this. Well, I say, well, we can't afford not to. And one of the things I'm particularly keen on, and I've been keen on for years, is why haven't we got a decent universal nursery education system in this country? Plenty of other countries have got it. In Scandinavia, they've had it for 50 years. It makes a huge difference to the quality of life in a society. This is our opportunity to actually think about the things we really want and to spend money on getting them. That would be my view. But that's not the view of the Labour Party leadership. They're playing safe. They're trying to keep everybody happy. They don't want to actually call a spade a spade. I mean, they're terrified of having to take responsibility for the situation.
But Claire, you're a cabinet member for children and young people. What are your thoughts on nursery education? Do you agree with Martin that there should be state provision? And do you think that we can afford it? Is it something we might see in the future?
Well, this is embarrassing. I find myself agreeing all the time, actually.
There's no reason why we shouldn't agree.
No, that's true. I think early years and the the quality that we can give to the youngest children is really very, very important. Otherwise, we tend to be playing catch-up all the time. So I think we really do need to give families and young children the very best that we can. And I do think we ought to, do our best to actually afford it. And I think the other thing which I would agree with are about the adult education cuts, because I feel so strongly that education is a vital part of society. We should be able to access it at all parts of our lives, because it delivers at so many different levels. So I will be fighting for everything I can for education.
Now, the first story we're looking at this week is Bristol University bosses who've been paid £100,000 a year while they're telling their own staff that they have to face job cuts. This is from the Bristol Evening Post on Tuesday this week. Almost 100 Bristol University staff earn more than £100,000 a year, and the Vice-Chancellor, Eric Thomas' salary package is more than £300,000. These new figures reveal a survey of higher education pay shows Mr. Thomas is the eighth highest paid university chief in the country, while Steve West, the Vice-Chancellor at the University of West of England, earns £255,000, and six other members of UE's senior team are paid more than £100,000. Both universities, though, are cutting jobs, and the University and College Union says there's no justification for Vice-Chancellors having bigger pay packets than the Prime Minister in these circumstances. Barry Taylor, who's Director of Communications for Bristol University, said that Mr. Thomas's pay of £271,000, which rises to £309,000 when you include pension contributions, was similar to that of other leading Russell Group universities. So what are your thoughts? Is it fair for these kind of salaries to be being paid to the bosses of Bristol University whilst they're saying that there's not enough money to pay for the staff? Claire, let's start with you.
Well, it's interesting, actually, because I think, you know, people will be trying to also come up with similar sort of stories with local authority and council officers as well. And I think there has got to be a sort of sense of solidarity that when people are having to face difficulties, cuts and so on, that it should be shared amongst everybody, really. But one of the things that we do find when we are recruiting is that if we get people in from the private sector who are interested in some of our jobs, in fact, they don't have the wide range of skill sets for the same salary as we would expect from people coming from the local authority. So, you know, I think probably there are quite high salaries being paid outside in industry and business.
Okay, Martin?
Yeah, I think I would agree with that. I mean, it's a populist move by the lecturers, obviously. I mean, that's what you do if you're workers and you're being having your pay cut or being made redundant. You say, well, that's not fair because these people are paid more than we are. But the point is that this kind of money, £100,000, people won't get out of the bed in the morning in the City of London for that. That's 1 week's bonus. And people don't realise that there's a huge gap between people at this level who are doing very serious jobs. I mean, managing a university is a very serious, high-level job. But it's a public sector job, so they get paid £100,000. If they were managing an organisation in the private sector with that sort of budget, they'd be paying much, much more than that. So you think people have no real sense of how the labour market works.
£309,000 salary is okay for Eric Thomas. Is that what you're saying?
I think that if you want the best people, you've got to pay the going rate for the job. If his best other job that he could do is in the private sector for double that money, if you want that person, you've got to pay them something that's consistent with the level of skill. And there's no reason why we shouldn't have differential pay for different levels of skill. What's really unfair is speculators in the City of London who are actually carrying out what is antisocial behaviour, paying themselves astronomic amounts of money, and this can't go on.
So do you think there's evidence that Eric has 20 times the skill, since he's being paid 20 times what some of the other staff are being paid?
Well, I mean, what's been happening over the last decades is that the shop floor used to earn about people at the top of industry used to earn about 15 or 16, 20 times what the shop floor earned. In the US, that's figures now something like 270 to 300 times, and this can't go on. It's not efficient, because these people can't spend all of that money. So what do they do with it? Well, they speculate with it and they create bubbles. If you took it off them, they couldn't do that.
Do we really need a chancellor and a vice chancellor? Because it sounds to me as if we were to get rid of one of them, we could also save 20 jobs at the university. Claire.
Sounds like you ought to apply for running the university. Actually, it sounds as though you could actually make some real changes there. I think the whole question of inequality between what people are paid at the sort of lower end and what people are paid at the very top has altered tremendously over the years, and I think there is evidence that in fact it isn't effective. In the sense in which it doesn't really drive forward people's sense of well-being. So I think there could be a movement coming along soon that says, look, we do actually need a more equal society, because we are reaping a lot of negative aspects by having this great disparity between people at the very top.
There's a study being done, and I can never remember the name of the academics who've done the study, but it's called the spirit level.
Yes.
And they show that the more equal a society is, the better social stats you have for everything, you know,
yes,
mental
for health.
Illness, health,
yes.
Everything. And it doesn't seem to matter that much what level you're on.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can be a poor country with an equal income distribution and you've got lots of positive effects. So it's not just the absolute amount of money. I mean, we are team animals. We work in teams. We think in team ways. That's why we like team games. And that's the managerial class have lost their way. You know, they're not actually
yes.
they're not actually leading from the front anymore.
No, and I think there's a strong sense of ghetto with some of these people, actually, that in many ways they don't actually understand what's going on. And I know it sounds very odd, but in fact I no longer drive. And one of the big advantages of not driving is you have to travel on buses. When you travel on buses, you hear all sorts of interesting conversations.
Indeed.
And it's just helpful in knowing how everybody lives.
But Polly Toynbee in The Guardian, she did a focus group with merchant bankers about a year ago.
Mm.
And she sat them down and she said, right, first question, chaps, what do you think the average wage is in Britain? And these guys are mathematics geniuses, many of them, and they spend all day moving huge amounts of money around with lots of noughts on the end.
Mm.
None of them knew. Mm. She said, all right, well, have a guess then. And the guy sat there and said, 50,000? That's how disconnected they are from reality.
Yes. So do you think this is also true for the top echelons at the university? Do you think they're living in a little bit of an ivory tower?
They've probably got more idea, frankly.
Mm.
Claire?
I would agree, because they will be dealing with students. And students come from quite a wide range of...
Yeah, carry on.
Sorry. students come from, a wide range of backgrounds, maybe not quite as wide as we would like, but nevertheless, they come from a wide range of backgrounds. So I think they probably are more connected with life than some of the merchant bankers of okay. this world.
Okay, well, we're now joined by Marina Morris. And Marina has a report. What is it this week, Marina?
The latest survey about scientific knowledge of children of primary and secondary school.
Right, lovely, thanks.
An online survey examining the scientific knowledge of 1,000 children in the UK primary and secondary school, undertaken earlier this month by one poll found. One in 10 children think the Queen invented the telephone. Others gave credit for the invention to Charles Darwin and Noel Edmonds. 8 out of 10 boys correctly identify Alexander Graham Bell as the inventor of the telephone. Compare this 69% of girls. Some 16% of 9 and 10 years old thought Sir Isaac Newton discovered fire. Other reports show that many school students are not interested in learning. Only 16% of children proactively talk about their school day. Almost half of children, 44%, don't like sharing information with their parents. They keep their school day privately, despite the more than 90% of children say their parents are interested in their education. Really, children are testing us. When we ask children what Newton or Bell discovered or invented, there is the relevant of them to them. The real key, however, is to develop the power of inquiry, a passion to find out how telephone or gravity works. The same survey shows that primary school children had a real interest in science, but the secondary school, many have lost interest in science. Nearly 70% of 9 and 10 years old would like to be famous for winning a Nobel Prize in science, and this has fallen to only 33% among 18 and 15 years old. The main question, how to unlock the potential of the children. The challenge for teachers and parents is to develop a focus on what interested children. This approach will motivate them and give them a clear perspective in life and knowledge.
Thank you, Marina. Now, Claire, as an ex-teacher yourself, would you agree that educationalists, if you can call them that, should be really thinking about how to provide the sort of education that children themselves want, the stuff that they're interested in?
Yes, I do, because actually if you're going to teach children, you really do have to start from where they are. It's no good saying, well, this is where I want you to be, and dragging them along there. You actually have to start from where they are. You start with their interests. And it's fascinating what people try and measure when they talk about education. So here we are testing as to whether they knew what Newton did. And, you know, at least they didn't think he invented apples.
Some of them probably did.
Maybe they did. So, you know, people are testing them on these sort of knowledge, whereas in reality, what we should be looking at is what happens if we introduce them to, to situations. How would they investigate spring, how a spring works, all those sorts of things. That's really where scientific interest comes from.
And do you think that, as a part of Marina's report there, that there are quite a lot of children who simply aren't interested in learning?
I think children are very interested in learning. I mean, you've only got to look at the way children develop, and it's just their instinct to explore. I think it's sad if as adults we knock it out of them in some way, but I think basically children are intent on learning because it's one of the ways they survive actually within the world. They've got to keep on learning all the time, and it's a question really of how we tap into that interest and how we develop it and how we give them the skills to carry on learning.
Martin, you were a teacher, even if it was in a sort of lefty school.
I used to teach A levels as well.
Okay, so could you give us your take on Marina's report then?
Yeah, well, I mean, my family were teachers on both sides, and I've been a teacher. I think many people are demoralised by what's happened. Many teachers are demoralised. My father is a head teacher of a comprehensive school. He took early retirement because he got so fed up with the direction in which things were going. Especially this kind of pernicious competition between schools, which seems so logical if people are privately educated, Tifton College versus Eton versus whoever. But in a local area like Bristol, you want every school to be a good school and everybody to be happy to go to the local school. I mean, I went to the local school when I was a child. I walked there. All my friends were there. It was all the people who lived in my street. And the children now in Bristol are being bussed from one side of the city to the other.
Claire, what's your thoughts about the league tables and competition between schools? Do you think that that's something that's improved education or not?
No, I don't think it has really improved education. I have to say that I don't want to go back to the days, I don't know whether any of your listeners will remember them, but William Tyndale School in London, that was dire because we were not offering the children what they actually needed.
Can you tell us about that?
It was one of those periods coming out of the Plowden Report, which was an investigative-led curriculum. Mm. Now, actually, when it's done properly, it is superb, but it's too easy for it not to be done properly and to end up in a laissez-faire situation.
Can you just explain what you mean by investigative-led curriculum? That's a pretty...
I'm beginning to wish I hadn't embarked on this, actually.
Yes. Martin.
It's a case of where you... Where you're topic-led, if you like. So they might work on fossils or something like that. That's my understanding of it. And it's an integrated curriculum. As I said before, it is extremely good when it's done really well.
So I remember when Plowden came in. I was in primary school.
What year was this then, roughly?
Sadly, it was in the 1960s, quite some time ago. But when I first went to school
No prizes for guessing our age then.
When I first went to school in 1964, we were all still sitting in rows of desks.
Yes.
And, you know, we had to put our hands up to go to the toilet, and there was a lot of chalk and talk from the front. Mm. And then as Plowden came in, suddenly the room was a more interesting room, and we had pictures on the wall, and we did things like creative writing. So I wrote my own story about something I was interested in.
Yes.
And one of the things that still used to upset me is I used to hand in my brilliant story, and they'd say, the spelling's wrong here, the spelling's wrong. They said, but you can... It doesn't, I used to get really frustrated with this. So I then went home and wrote my own stories with my spelling, and I've still got them. And they are part of my education myself. My spelling eventually became absolutely perfect. But when you're five, you can't spell everything. You spell it phonetically. And yes, you don't want to be told that you haven't spelt it right. Is this a good story? That's what you want to hear from the teacher.
Yes. Yes, and if I can just go back to a comment that Martin made about the competitiveness between schools. One of the things that I'm very encouraged by with the secondary schools in Bristol is that I think we did go through a competitive age. It was very much part of competition driving up standards. But what we are finding now is that there is a great collegiality between the heads, and I think it's that cooperation, that willingness to share good practice, which is far more effective in driving up standards.
I wonder whether driving up standards has not been part of the whole process of grade inflation, so that everybody ends up with a first or whatever, or an A, and we're trying to encourage people. But I don't think that's, you know, many people are now getting much better grades than they got previously, but whether they are actually as educated as they were in previous generations is a moot point. And we don't want to water down the grading system. We want to actually fit the education to the child. And so not everybody is going to be a genius. IQ of 100 is the average. That means that half the children will be below average, and half of them will be above. And there's only, you know, you can't actually put everybody to the highest level. It's not feasible. And the national curriculum has been driven very much by an academic-style curriculum, hand-me-down from the university. Mm. And that's not necessarily relevant to kids who are going to go working in as motor mechanics or whatever. They need to get hands-on at an earlier stage. They don't actually need to know who invented the telephone. They need to fiddle with the telephone and see how it works. You know, that's what they need to be doing.
And be able to put it back together again after they've dismantled it. That's a great help as well. But it's true, actually, about the comment about education coming down from the universities. And I think that that's something that we have to battle with, because the reality is that children grow up through schools, you know, so in a sense nursery should be informing reception, informing primary and so on, and I think that's more important than going the other way.
Can I just make another comment? We're getting stuck on education, I know, Tony, but in Scandinavia they all go to nursery school age 4, but they don't actually try and teach them to read until they're 7, so they get 4 years of play and social interaction. And that's a solid basis for all of their children. And when it comes to A level and so on, they're as good as ours.
Yes.
Okay. Now, Marina Morris has also been out on the streets this week to have a chat to you, the people of Bristol, to see what you think about Bristol's education. And so let's have a listen to that report now.
What are your experiences of the standards of education in Bristol?
It needs improvement. As a former employer, I had people apply for jobs with me who were unable to communicate properly, couldn't do simple arithmetic. I've seen with my children and grandchildren that the deterioration of what I considered standards has continued. I'm prejudiced. Because if a parent considers that their child's education and therefore future will be improved, or it will be a benefit to them to change to a different stream, then they should be allowed to do it. And they are responsible for their child's development.
In Bristol, I didn't go to school in Bristol. I went to university here, and I was very pleased with the standard of education. I went to the University of West England, and it's quite a good university.
I think it's to do with management culture that's very outdated. People have been in the job far too long and have got no experience of anywhere else. So when they talk about excellence, they actually have got no real idea what excellence means. And it actually means just above average, if not below average. So, but how you try and communicate that to some of the people in Bristol, senior management and councillors, is hard, because they might be some of the average ones we're talking about.
Well, my own experience is that they are very, very good myself. when I was young. Yes, I think it was very good, yeah. I think a lot of parents move to be near the school of their choice, but then that means that other schools are going to be like sink schools, and that's not right either.
What are the characteristics of a good teacher, and have you any message to the council?
An individual who will listen, will consider, and will then put forward a reasoned argument or discussion.
Both my sister and my mother are teachers, so I've sort of got family connections that are teachers. I guess key skill, teachers have to be caring, but they also have to be quite astute, and they really have to sort of get children to learn, particularly with children who are sort of less keen to learn. It's really about sort of finding chinks in the armour, what they are good at and how to engage with them, whether that's sort of verbally or otherwise. So it's really sort of exploiting the identification of any opportunity that they have. Teachers have to be very organised as well. So I'd say organisation and sort of actually being quite astute and dedicated. I mean, it's quite a hard profession, but there are good teachers around, and I'm sure there's many teachers that could do assistance. Well, I guess the first issue for the council is probably to sort out the school places in terms of the sort of quantity. I think they've been caught slightly short with the sort of population projections for the younger demographic.
I mean, sometimes the best teachers aren't necessarily those who know so much about their subject, it's from those who care about their pupils and on an individual level. So that's where my thought was going, passion and enthusiasm, but married with a certain degree of care for their pupils and their future. Sometimes it's not necessarily about increased funding, it's about some of the people in some of the posts, and my experience of Bristol City Council is that, again, there's incompetent managers and too many of them at every level. How you go about getting rid of some of those people is very difficult because their redundancy packages are huge and they've been in post for a long time and they control budgets, and there's a lot of them, and I think you need to sort of bring in new people who've got a bit of energy and a bit of less of a connection to the old system. Yeah,
I would say encouragement and patience and positive approach rather than negative approach, so I think that will get the best out of, you know, children having to learn more. Hopefully not to make any cuts, because that's going to be very damaging.
That was Marina Morris, Vox Pops, talking to the people of Bristol. That's you out there on the streets earlier on this week about education in the city. Now, Claire Campion is with us. She's the Cabinet Member for Children and Young People. Claire, what did you think of what you heard there?
I found it very interesting, and I think there were some very good and perceptive comments about it. I rather like the one about you have to find a chink in the armour in order to really to galvanise young people. And I wouldn't describe it necessarily as a chink in the armour, but you do have to start from where children are, which is what we were discussing beforehand. I think there is an admiration for the job that teachers are doing, and certainly I think that teachers are far more professional nowadays than they used to be. They're very focused on what they need to do and on the outcomes that they need to achieve, and I think it's good that we recognise the quality of teaching and also the quality of the work that goes on. I liked another comment about, I can't remember it exactly, but it implied that a good teacher should be a listener. And I think that gives an indication that learning is very much a two-way process between teacher and learner.
Why do you think that teachers do need to find a chink in the armour? Do you think it's uncool to be sort of academic when you're maybe sort of in your teens? Or is that what you've come across?
Well, certainly, I mean, when my children went to school, one of the worst things that you could be called was a keener. So, yes, I think there's a certain amount of laid-backness about young people.
Martin's smiling there. I wonder whether he was a keener. Martin,
I tried not to be.
Well, there you are. I think that proves my point.
And Martin, what are your take on that?
I think one of the problems we've got is that schools perform a number of functions. One is to educate and impart knowledge. The other thing that they have to do is to bring up people who are going to be good citizens and able to build families and so on. And of course, because of all of the social problems that we've had in this country over the last decades, there is a small minority of children who haven't got stable backgrounds. They come into school with all sorts of problems. My sister's working in a unit over in Cheltenham at the moment with kids who've been excluded from schools because they've just been such a nuisance to other children. And the measurement for a teacher dealing with those kind of children shouldn't be how many exams they've passed. It's not reasonable. You've got to actually look at what can we do with these children whose mother is a drug addict, whose father is in prison. And what you've got to do is start where they are, which is, look, don't ruin your life by getting involved in all this stuff. Think about something else that you'd like to do. And that won't necessarily be passing an exam and going to university. It might be because you're good at basketball or knitting or anything. Let's find out what it is.
But Claire,
instead of testing kids to find out what they can't do, let's find out what they can do.
But Claire, we've got to get this right, haven't we? Because if we don't, we're storing up problems for the future. So what are you doing, what are you able to do from your job on the cabinet of the City Council to make sure that Bristol's youngsters are getting educated better in the future?
Yes, I think it's trying to make sure that we do keep focus, and I'm not going to say necessarily on exam results, but we keep a focus on children moving ahead and moving ahead as quickly as they can. I think we have to make sure that we keep that breadth of education that you were talking about, because I think that that is absolutely essential. I think we have got to be an authority that can attract the very best teachers to it, because they sense a creativity within Bristol, and a sense that education is very, very important to us. So it's creating that sort of atmosphere, which I think is one of the things that I can do to the best of my ability, and which I think will be important.
Okay, so we're coming up to, it's 25 to 6 now, you have chosen some music, haven't you, Claire, this week? And it's only a short piece, but would you like to just introduce it and tell us why you chose that piece?
I suppose if I was absolutely honest, I forgot to bring a piece of music, so Tony chose it for me.
Well, I gave you the CD, but
you've
chosen a track off of it, haven't you?
I have, yes. And it's Handel. I'm very fond of classical music. I've chosen a minuet because I find that minuets are very often gentle and lilting, and I think we might need it on a Friday evening.
From Handel's Amarilla Suite, that was the minuet chosen by this week's guest, Claire Campion-Smith, who's Lib Dem councillor and on the cabinet on the City Council for Children and Young People. And our next story is Gordon Brown, who led the funeral tributes last week to Michael Foot. This was Michael Foot's funeral. I wonder if both of you just like to give briefly your thoughts on this ex-Labour leader and his legacy. Martin, first, as your old Labour fella?
Well, obviously, he was a man very close to the heart of the Labour Party. I understood when he was invited for his 90th birthday to meet Tony Blair at 10 Downing Street, he made a very pointed remark about Iraq. He was also one of the opposers of appeasement in the 1930s. I used to be an aid worker in Bosnia, and he spoke out very strongly about that. I didn't always agree with everything that he said or did. But I think it's quite interesting that the 1983 manifesto, the so-called longest suicide note in history, Gerald Kaufman called it that, as Michael Foot said, yes, you got elected on that suicide note. And of course, what were the main things in that suicide note, as it was called, the Labour election manifesto of 1983, was scrap Trident and nationalise the banks.
Claire.
Yes, he was actually came from a very strong political family. So and
they were liberals, weren't they? Mostly.
Yes, they were, and they were very interesting people actually, with a lot of with huge principles. And I think it's sad that he's died, because I think we need his. He did have a good innings, that's quite true. But I think he did make a very big contribution to the whole philosophy of politics
but
in this country.
But it's streets away, miles away from the politics of now, isn't it, Martin and Claire? The sort of things that Michael Foot was putting across, particularly to do with managing the economy and that kind of thing, were much more, shall we say, old-style socialist, not like the New Labour style at all.
Well, of course, but in actual fact, many of the things that were, if we'd nationalised the banks in 1983, have, you know, think on what might have happened. We wouldn't be in the mess we're in now. And we've had to nationalise them in the end anyway, at great expense, because we've nationalised them in a rush without understanding why we're doing it and just doing it as a last-ditch measure. If the financial sector had been properly nailed down before all this happened, perhaps we wouldn't be in the mess. And the root of the mess, of course, is the deregulation of the financial sector in the 1980s, the so-called Big Bang, which the Conservatives brought in. And that was a silly thing to do. But we are now realising how silly it was.
Michael Foot didn't have the presentational skills or the charisma of David Cameron or someone like that.
Watching him speaking during the 1983 election campaign, and he was a great orator of the old style, speaking to mass meetings. And he made a sweeping gesture with his arm, as you do as an orator, and he knocked the microphone on the floor, and then he just carried on gesticulating, and then you could see his managers going, oh no, this won't do, because of course, you know, modern TV based presentation is sound bites, you know, 14 seconds. It's not like Lloyd George speaking for 4 hours and people sitting there in the rain listening to it. I mean, he was of that generation where that kind of speaking was what you did. And I think actually people need to actually see some more of that again. That's quite inspiring. I've stood in some political demonstrations and seen some fantastic speeches.
Yes, and the art of oratory is something which I think has gone to some extent, because now if you're trained for the media, then you're trained to make your 3 points.
That's right.
You're trained to do all sorts of things like quietly avoiding the question.
So do you think we've
whilst you make your 3 points.
Any budding orators on the city council that you've seen at council meetings? Anyone that's actually got your heart beating and... it'd be nice to say yes, wouldn't it?
It would be nice if we could say yes. I think quite often you sit
Hitler.
There. you sit there and you think that person speaks an awful lot of sense. And the council chamber isn't really a place for great oratory. So really what we're looking for are people who speak common sense.
Okay, now our next story. A schoolgirl of 14 gave lap dances at a club whilst her mother thought she was on a sleepover. This is a big story broken by the Sun newspaper earlier this week. Schoolgirl aged 14 has been working as a lap dancer in a club in Weston-super-Mare. The underage teen was seen drinking vodka, Alco Pops and giving a £20 a time naked dances for men at the Shadow Lounge in Weston-super-Mare in Somerset. Jesus Rodriguez Casas, who's the owner of the Shadow Lounge in Weston-super-Mare, I don't know quite whether he's going to be prosecuted for this, but what are your thoughts, first of all, Claire?
Well, I sincerely hope he is prosecuted, actually, because there's no way that he ought to be employing children of this age.
Well, he would say, of course, I didn't know she was so young, won't he?
Well, he may do, but I don't think that that's an excuse, actually. So I very much hope that he will be prosecuted. I'd be absolutely horrified as a mother to discover that this was happening. And it does bring up all sorts of questions, really, about the role of parents, about how you really do actually have to check up on who your children are with, and what they're doing. And maybe you do it in a slightly light touch way, but it is a big responsibility bringing up children.
Martin?
Well, obviously I agree with that. I mean, you can't be employing underage children in a lap dancing club. It's illegal. He should have asked what her age was, and that's that. And if he didn't do it, they should close the place down.
What if she lied about it because she thinks it's cool?
He's responsible for finding out what her age is. Yeah, she should come along with a birth certificate. If she's 16 or over, fine, that's okay. But if she's 14, no.
Okay, next story. We can't shun countries that use torture, says the Foreign Office. Britain cannot afford the luxury, apparently, of only cooperating with countries which do not use torture, says the Foreign Office. A statement in the department's annual human rights report will fuel suspicions that UK intelligence agencies collaborated with the harsh treatment of detainees abroad, like Benjamin Mohammed, who we've covered several weeks on this programme. What's going on here, Claire? Because it does seem that the Foreign Office is saying, well, we just simply have to cooperate with these countries that are breaking international law and conventions on human rights and various things like that. So should we be cooperating with countries like that?
It does sound rather mealy-mouthed, really, doesn't it? And I think this is what people find difficult about politicians. It is difficult sometimes to keep a very upright and rigorous position, but nevertheless, this country can still exert a lot of influence in various ways. So I would really be wanting to ask the Foreign Office, okay then, so you're dealing with this country, but what are you actually doing to use your influence so that human rights are respected?
Yeah, so what I suppose you're suggesting there is that the Foreign Office should simply not deal with any countries who are using torture. That would be rather difficult for them, wouldn't it?
Yes, I think it would, and I'm not sure that I actually went that far. But as I said, I mean, I think when you're dealing with countries, then in fact you do have a sphere of influence there, and it's to the extent to which you use the power of your influence to make sure that human rights are properly regarded.
Martin.
Well, as you know, a few months ago we had Dan Norris, who's a minister, on this programme, the same week that the head of MI5 was in Bristol University justifying torture in exactly this kind of way. And as a minister, he was facing both ways. Of course we're against torture. Torture is illegal. It's a criminal offence. But, and I say, well, what? Where's the but? There should be no but. We do have to deal with countries that torture, but we don't have to be involved in it. That's the point.
Yes.
Yeah? And of course, one of the countries which has been very much involved in torture is our major ally, the United States of America. At Fort Benning in Georgia, throughout the 1960s, 1970s, 1980s and up to date, all the major torturers in Latin America, Noriega, Galtieri, were all trained in torture techniques by the CIA at Fort Benning in Georgia. And they're still training people in torture techniques there today. And I think we really seriously have to ask ourselves a question. Is there a rule of law in the United States of America? Because many people around the world don't think there is.
Okay, another big story this week is a local one, which is Bristol's Tesco Challenge. And this was actually in the Guardian newspaper on Wednesday. Can you shop in all 17 stores in 1 hour? That's all 17 Tescos that are in and around Bristol city centre. Tesco wants to open an 18th store. And, of course, on Tuesday this week, there was a big close down of Cheltenham Road. And here's a little extract from one of the travel bulletins, which advised people to avoid Cheltenham Road on Tuesday.
And finally in Bristol, the Cheltenham Road, the A38, that's closed between Ashley Road and Upper York Street because of an ongoing police incident. Nick Duncalf, 5 Live Travel.
Well, it was a little bit more than an ongoing police incident. It was a full-scale eviction with many bailiffs and police, even police with riot gear, hanging around the corner just in case, and about 200-300 spectators with probably about 100 court officials and police. One of the first things I'd like to do is just have a listen now to, first of all, one of the squatters who squatted Tesco's Jesters, which the idea is this is part of a campaign to stop Tesco's putting their 18th store in the city centre on the Cheltenham Road, and then that's followed by a chat I had with a lady from across the road.
The planning system, in this case at least, has been completely farcical. Tesco claims to have consulted 52 people who live locally as to whether it was all right for them to move in here, and we've gone door to door, talked to people. We've had hundreds, I think over 1,000 people sign a petition saying that they don't want a Tesco's here, and we haven't found a single person who's been publicly consulted out of any of the neighbours. I mean, it seems completely ludicrous, the idea that there has been any democratic process that's gone through here. As far as I can see, it's been all about the money.
For someone who's never actually been evicted themselves, what was it like this morning? What happened?
There's been a lot of tension in our crew for a while because we knew that it was going to happen soon. We had a tip-off that it was going to happen today. So we kind of tried to alert local people through a phone tree which had a couple of hundred people on it so that they'd turn out for the eviction. And it's just been great to see how many people have turned up, how supportive they've been, and how much of a rejection there's been of this eviction attempt.
So what next then?
And this isn't the end of it, this is just the beginning really.
My name is Sally. I live almost opposite the proposed new Tesco site. I think that it's inappropriate for Tesco's to have a shop here because it's an area of lots of independent stores. There's a Tesco's a mile up the road, two Tesco's half a mile down the road, and there's absolutely no need for Tesco's to build.
But, I mean, you live right opposite. You're going to use it if it opens, aren't you?
Unfortunately, I probably will, which actually makes me feel very cross with myself. But it will be convenient, but I still feel it's inappropriate. I actually went and looked at the planning application, and Tesco's was extremely devious. They used a commercial company to put the planning application in for them for change of usage from a club to a shop, and there was absolutely no mention anywhere in the planning application that it was Tesco's putting in the application.
What are your thoughts about what's been going on here today with people actually occupying the building?
And I've supported them. I have lived opposite. There has been no issue as far as I'm concerned. They've played a bit of music in the evenings, but it stopped at a decent hour, hasn't kept me awake. And it's all been a very peaceful demonstration against Tesco's, and I think it's been absolutely appropriate.
Well, first it was over in Bedminster, in Southville, where Tesco's were talking about putting a big, massive superstore over there. Now it's just these tiny stores which seem to be irking people. Claire, what's your thoughts about this? Should Tesco's just be allowed to put shops wherever they want? And how come they've managed to get planning permission for change of use without even saying it's a Tesco's shop that was there? By being a little bit nifty, doing their consultation, but never mentioning Tesco's as part of that consultation?
I think a lot of people feel that Tesco's are extremely nifty in all sorts of ways. And it's interesting, actually, that they do provoke a reaction in people. And I wasn't actually there at the time, and I don't know the councillor, but it is reported that at a planning meeting, one of the rather old-fashioned Bristol councillors was heard to declare, "I hate Tesco." I think they create this sort of reaction because they seem prepared to ride roughshod over people in many ways. So our ward in Henlees was won about 15 years ago, and it was won after a battle to build a superstore on Golden Hill. And it's this feeling that they profit is there and they will do what they can to get that profit.
Well, the one of the problems here is about a mile up the road or half a mile or so, there's another Tesco's, and a mile
yes.
down the road, there are another two Tesco's. This will be very, very badly affect many of the little shops around this part of Cheltenham Road, the Ashley Road Junction area. Is there actually anything that the citizens of Bristol and councillors can do about this kind of thing, or should Tesco's just have the right to be able to buy up and put shops wherever they feel that they want to do that, no matter what the effect is on local people?
No, I think local people can protest at the planning stage because we do have policies about keeping the health of local shopping streets, and part of the health of local shopping streets is getting variety there. Interestingly enough, you do need a supermarket of the right size, really, because that brings people there and then they visit the other shops as well. So it's getting the right mixture of supermarkets and the other shops as well that really keeps the health of a local street going. But it does sound to me as though they've got an awful lot of Tesco's in this particular part of the city, and I would have thought that that would have been a planning issue to be considered.
Well, if this is allowed to carry on, surely all we will have is large chain supermarkets like Morrison's, Tesco's, Sainsbury's, and the smaller versions of them. All of the local traders will be forced out ultimately, won't they?
I think they're going to have to find their own niche in some way. So I very much hope, actually, that greengrocers will stay despite the supermarkets. I think the reality is, though, that these supermarkets can open for extended hours, and that really does suit modern life for many people. So yes, we say that we want this variety, and then it just becomes so convenient to pop into the supermarket. So if we want variety, then we've got to try and keep local businesses going as well.
Well, I agree with that. It's very hard to stop people doing something which they've got a legal right to do. The planning law basically allows people to do things unless there's a very good reason not.
So do you think that's why this has ended in violence between the police?
It didn't end in violence. Everybody said it was very peaceful.
Well, there was quite a lot of argy-bargy between the police and the demonstrators and the occupiers. I wouldn't say necessarily too much violence, but you know, certainly there were some clashes as I was down there for about an hour or so. And this isn't the way to sort things out, is it? Surely we need to be able to find a way of making sure that
people should be
that shops like this are only put there if this is something that the people want. It's not democratic, is it, to what's happened here?
Well, there's resistance, obviously. The local people don't actually want the shop, quite clearly. And I think I live on Stapleton Road, and actually, to be honest with you, all the shops I need are there. And the prices are just as good as the supermarket. And not everybody's got a car to go to the supermarket. So I've got a fishmonger's over the road.
But these are small convenience shops. This is the whole point.
There's plenty of small convenience shops in Stokes Croft at the moment.
These big supermarkets have kind of taken over the out-of-town market of big supermarkets, and they're now looking at trying to take over the small corner shop market too, aren't they?
Well, the Monopolies and Mergers Commission need to look at supermarkets, don't they?
Yes, I think they do, actually. And the reality of local businesses is that they keep the money circulating within the local community, whereas some of these big chains, it gets sucked away to, dare I say it, offshore places. And I think for the health of our city, we need to keep local shops.
Okay, this Lib Dem myth. This is a story that Martin drew to my attention, because he knew Claire was going to be in this week from the Liberal Democrat Party in Bristol. And this is at the last an article by Tim Horton in Wednesday's Guardian. At the last election, 2 million Labour supporters switched to the Liberal Democrats, many in protest over the war in Iraq. They've been urged to stick with this choice in 2010 by the former New Statesman editor John Kampfner, who reports that he feels more at home with the Lib Dems than with Labour. Now, Martin, why did you bring this to my attention? Why do you think this is an important article?
Well, I think that Labour and the Liberal Democrats have many things in common, as we've discovered sitting here today. We're trying to find things to disagree about. One of the things I agree about with the Liberal Democrats is about proportional representation. I mean, we've just got to have it. We can't carry on with this tweedledum, tweedledee politics. But what's interesting about this piece for me is that Nick Clegg is now, presumably because of the possibility of a coalition with the Conservatives, he's starting to talk Conservative language about spending cuts. He praised Margaret Thatcher. He even used the phrase savage spending cuts not long ago. And this worries me, because we need a consensus going forward, and that consensus shouldn't be based around this old neoliberal think. We've got to start thinking forwards and looking backwards to the Keynesian era, where we actually see the positive in government intervention, and liberals have had the Liberal Party has had a fantastic tradition. Keynes was a liberal. Pensions were brought in by the Liberal government in the 1900s.
Beveridge was a liberal.
Yes, indeed.
Okay, let's let Claire answer.
So I'm worried that Nick is betraying liberal principles.
Okay,
if you like.
Right. Well, I was at the Spring Conference last week in Birmingham, and I have to say that some of the quotes which you have mentioned there, I would be very interested to know where they came from, because it certainly wasn't the language that was being spoken there, and it wasn't just the language that Nick Clegg was using, it was the language which was being spoken in all the debates. And at a Lib Dem conference, there is still the possibility that you will change policy, so the debate is important. There is a strong sense coming out that our economic policy has got to be sound, and also that we have got to make it as fair as possible. So I can see no indication of moving towards conservative policies in any way.
Well, okay.
If we could find conservative policies.
Okay. We're coming up to the Time for the Sky News at 6 now. Thanks to this week's guest, Lib Dem Councillor Vahen Lees and Bristol Cabinet Member for Children and Young People, Claire Campion-Smith. Next week at 5 on Friday Drive Time, we're joined by Lib Dem Councillor Vahen Grove and Chair of Bristol City Council Licensing Committee, Mary Sykes. After the 6 o'clock news, in a report carried over from last week, we ask, who is ex-SAS Major John Wick, the man with a copy of the private House of Commons hard drive who started the MP's expenses scandal? And we're joined by Chris Hawkins, ex-merchant banker and on the board of Barton Hills Community at Heart. He'll be discussing the recession with Martin Summers. Will it double dip? Also, we'll be talking to Chris about his current work as part of the Child and Parent Alliance.